What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal tug war.
Join me, Scott Whitey, as I chat all things Pacific politics on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favourite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Yakwe, hafa a day, no ia e Māori. And malo ni and goodfellow morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm your host, Aggie DeWall, and it is definitely great to be back. Thank you to the team, though, for looking after the show and being able to bring you the latest in news and views from across the region. Well, coming up on the show, we'll head to Fiji to discuss its independent commission against corruption. It was again under intense scrutiny after arrests were made to a prominent online writer publishing allegations made by an internal whistleblower. There's pushback from Senate against accepting US deportees as listed for a hearing in Palau's Supreme Court.
We wrote our letter to President Weeps that we are not ready to accept these people at this time. And he took that message and went to the United States. When he returned and said, the United States is offering us money. We don't need money to sell our country.
And the third round of the OFC Pro League rolls into Melbourne. As you can hear, there's plenty of excitement.
I came here 3 hours just to be here to cheer me for my country. My country, Papua New Guinea. Go Hekari PNG.
All that and more. But before we start, let's acknowledge that our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Thank you to Mas. Thank you again for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We begin with the Fiji Independent Commission Against Corruption, who was again under intense scrutiny after it arrested a prominent online writer who'd published allegations made by an internal whistleblower. FICAC officers arrested former journalist Charlie Charters at Nundi Airport on Saturday, and he remains in detention at the commission's office in Suva. In recent weeks, Charters had posted documents and commentary online raising questions about improper connections between people at FICAC and the Fiji Sports Council. A statement released by his lawyer said he's being investigated over alleged involvement with a whistleblower. So serious is the situation that the body that appoints the FICAC Commissioner, the Judicial Services Commission, held an emergency meeting and is due to make recommendations to the President later today. For more on this story, we cross to Fiji and our reporter there, Lide Mavono. That Yandere, Lide, thank you for joining us.
Yandere Vinaka, good to be with you again, Agnes.
Thank you so much. Look, Lide, what exactly happened at Nundi Airport on Saturday?
Charlie Charters was stopped at Nundi Airport on Saturday, the 31st of February, Agnes, while he was on his way to board a Fiji Airways flight to Sydney. He had work meetings in Sydney over the weekend and was on his way to attend those. But immigration officers acted on an alert, a red note is what they called it, that was linked to his file and put there by the Fiji Independent Commission Against Corruption, FICAC. He was then placed in police custody, and then FICAC took him away, transported him back to Suva later that evening. And he has remained in the custody of FICAC investigators here in the city. There's been no publicly confirmed formal charges. And in fact, as of last night, the FICAC investigators were still not done with their caution interview with him. But Agnes, later this afternoon, the 48-hour limit on how long you can hold a suspect before you charge and produce them in court is coming up.
Well, Lida, do we know what FICAC is actually alleging against Charlie Charters?
Yes, we do. Well, at least we only know what the lawyers acting for Charlie Charters have been able to tell us. The evening that he was brought in, the head of the Fiji Law Society, Wiley Clark, as well as Charlie Charters' lawyer, Mr. Sefron Fatiaki, did go and meet with investigators to do a welfare check. We had been calling on government ministers and high-ranking officials throughout the afternoon on Saturday to check if he was okay at the very least, because no one had seen him. And what we were able to find out from the lawyers late on Saturday night is that he is being investigated and likely to be charged with aiding and abetting a whistleblower. At least that's what the lawyers said, investigators told them. And that is reportedly in relation to Section 45 of the Crimes Act, which is to do with the FICAC legislation. And the act is talking about unlawful disclosure of official information. So kind of a secrecy clause, if we can call it that. And so the investigation appears to be centered on some documents that had been released by Charlie earlier that week, around the 18th or the 19th of February. And it had been circulating publicly. People have paid quite a lot of attention to what Charlie reports on his Facebook page about the FICAC. And he's been doing this since the middle of last year to the late of last year. However, Agnes, as I said earlier, there's still no formal charges. There's actually also no formal word from FICAC. Both I and our partners at the Fiji Broadcasting, who have been covering this on the weekend, has made numerous attempts to get the FICAC head, Ms. Lavinia Rokoika, to respond to statements or at least give us some welfare information around Charlie, who, by the way, is a cancer survivor and has heart condition. So far, we've still not received any public information as to what exactly he is meant to have done wrong, Agnes.
Right. So, again, if there's no formal charges, what has Charters and his legal team sort of said about his detention then?
Well, as of last night, we're beginning to see a lot more strong language coming out of Charlie Charters' team. What they're accusing FICAC of is basically, in the simple terms, abusing the power given to them by the FICAC Act. And they're saying this because while the FICAC investigators have had Charlie in custody, they've offered him multiple times the ability to walk away from detention, to walk away from investigation, if he would only just give them the name of his whistleblower. And so far, Charlie has, you know, refused to do that. And what his lawyers are saying is that that is an indication that they don't have even the name of the whistleblower yet, and they don't have, specific charges coming, but are rather using the powers of the FICAC Act to control him, or to coerce him rather, into revealing information about this whistleblower. And they're saying that it is more about, you know, compelling the disclosure of confidential sources as opposed to actually having evidence to charge the whistleblower and therefore charging him with aiding and abetting that. And it's causing quite a widespread condemnation of FICAC, Agnes.
Now, I understand that the Judicial Services Commission, they stepped in on Sunday. Why was that?
Well, see, the Judicial Services Commission is the only body that is mandated by law to hire and fire the head of FICAC, along with several other democratic institutions. And so when this happened to Charlie on Saturday, there was widespread condemnation. The Media Association especially have led a call for Charlie's release and a call for transparency, because Charlie, you know, used to work as a journalist here in Fiji when he lived here when he was younger. And a lot of the work that he's been doing since the middle of last year, raising awareness on, you know, the things that are going wrong or the things that are controversial within FICAC, he has been doing in tandem with local media. He's been doing and releasing information to local media. And so the Judicial Services Commission, as of last night, put out a statement to say that they saw the public condemnation, they saw the public call, and that was one of the three reasons they sat yesterday. The other two reasons reasons was, of course, to act on a court order from 2 weeks prior as to the lawfulness of the appointment of the woman who currently heads FICAC. Mm-hmm. And so as of last night, the JSC has indicated that they will, in fact, they have already, in fact, written a letter making recommendations to the president today as per that court directive. And so over the next couple of hours, we should hopefully see copies of that letter and see this JSC, the Judicial Services Commission, act on both the court order as well as the detention of Charlie Charters, Agnes.
But Lide, besides all of that, is there anything else or what may be happening next, both for Charters and for FICAC itself?
Well, look, there are some, you know, there's some strong indications as to what could be in that letter going to the president, and highly likely in my list anyway, is that the Judicial Services Commission, they have very little choice. All they can do really is act on the court order, and the court order is very explicit on the fact that the Prime Minister acted unlawfully when he advised the president to remove Barbara Malimali, who had been recruited to the position under a process, and replaced her with Lavinia Rokoika, the woman who heads FICAC and under whose direction those investigators at FICAC would have detained Charlie Charters. So what we do, it's highly likely that that letter will be calling on the president to action the court order and to remove Lavinia Rokoika. The other thing, though, is that we don't, the court order wasn't explicit as to the reinstatement of Barbara Malimali, but it does throw that appointment power back to the JSC, or rather reminds them that that is their prerogative. So that's another thing to look out for. And once Lavinia Rokoika is removed from that position, there will be a vacuum as to who has the legal authority to detain Charlie Charters. So that'll be another thing that we will see next once the president acts on the court order, is there will have to be a delegation of power. Somebody else, some other prosecutorial authority will then have to take over Charlie Charters' detention. And in Fiji, the only other organization that can do that is, of course, the Office of the Director of Public Prosecution. So we should be seeing that happening in the next few hours. But the 48-hour limit does come up at 2:30 local time. So they either have to charge him and produce him in court or let him go a little after lunchtime today, Agnes.
Well, Lide, as always, thank you so much for keeping us across that situation that is happening right there in Fiji. As always, vinaka whakalevo.
Vinaka.
That is our reporter in Fiji, Lide Movono.
Want the latest Pacific Rugby League and Union news and interviews with stars of the game? Tune in to Nation Footy with Sam Wykes and Tinirau Arona.
Well, do you reckon just on that one, I could get a gig with your commentary?
I know. You know what? I have to get you to say the names first. Say the names first. You get the pronunciations right, you're in.
The numbers in, mate.
You're in.
Nation Footy, Monday afternoons at 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Kia ora, kutuka totoa. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, Palau's Supreme Court has denied an application by the country's Senate for a stay order on the government's plan to take third country nationals deported from the United States. Palau's president says dormitories to house the deportees are being built and the country is ready to accept the new arrivals. But there's plenty of pushback. A civil case is listed for trial and the country's Senate and Council of Chiefs are questioning the president's motives. Whenau Whanua files this report.
The controversial deal will allow up to 75 third country deportees from the US to live and work in Palau in exchange for $7.5 million in development funds. Palau Senate pushed a bill proposing amendments that would have effectively prevented the deal from being implemented. The Senate also filed an emergency request to block the deal from taking effect, but the request was denied last week by the country's Supreme Court.
I think the message is clear. Our constituents are telling us, go forward.
Palau's president, Soranga Whips Jr., is confident his deal will be carried through. And from the outside looking in, that appears to be the case. He says facilities to accommodate them have already been set up.
We've prepared the dormitories at the college where they would stay there. When they come, they're not detainees. They would just stay in a normal college dorm and be part of our community and then start meeting prospective employers. So we're ready. And so we're helping the United States. But at the same time, I think we're doing a great service to those people. We help them too. Them better than being in detention camps or wherever they are in the United States.
The president of Palau's Senate, Hakim Bowles, is vigorously opposed to the deal in its current form. He says the Senate, along with the Council of Chiefs, a body composed of traditional leaders, oppose the deal, and that President Wip's motive is U.S. money.
On behalf of the people of the Palau, the leadership of Palau, the Congress and the Council of Chiefs, we wrote our letter to President Wip that we are not ready to accept these people at this time, so we will not accept them until such time we are ready to accept them. And he took that message and went to the United States. But when he returned and said, the United States is offering us money. Why don't we take this since we need money? We don't need money to sell our country.
Senator Ball says few Palauans want deportees in their society. He says the U.S. is exploiting Palau to serve its own interests.
Our president said these are not criminal. So why the U.S. is deporting them? We want to know why. United States is a very big country. They can accept anybody in the world. Palau is a small country. We are only about 20 to 30,000 people. Why do we have to busy with other countries' people? Deportees. We feel they're dumping their problem in Palau. Why they choose Palau so small? Why they don't send them to Australia? Palau sovereignty is disrespected at this time.
For the Senate's bill to come into effect, the House of Representatives would need to pass the bill, and then the president himself would have to sign off on it. So what do ordinary Palauans think of the political debates over the country accepting deportees? Ongaran Kambis Kesole, a journalist and founder of a local think tank, the Compass Point Institute, says many people are unaware of the situation.
The public has not really digested what is out there or aware of the court ruling at this moment.
He says the court decision is a win for President Wip's as it gives him a legal standing. But Mr. Kesole doesn't think it will put an end to the debate.
I think this court order did not make it any better. In fact, I'm expecting that the administration, the Wip's, President Wip's, would be using this as one way of further their argument that, there is nothing wrong with what they're doing.
And that was Ongerong Kambis Kesole, Palauan journalist and founder of a local think tank, the Compass Point Institute. And as we mentioned, a civil case lodged by the Senate against accepting US deportees is listed for hearing in Palau's Supreme Court. Now, the Australian Federal Police have launched a new task force in far north Queensland, and one of its aims is to tackle drug smuggling from the Pacific. It will also investigate organised crime, forced labour and potential foreign interference. The AFP says illegal drugs have been stockpiled in the Pacific, and the task force will prevent them from being brought into Australia. AFP Commissioner Chrissy Barrett says the team based out in Cairns have already started their investigations.
This new AFP QPS task force will help ring fence North Queensland and our region from criminals in Australia and offshore who are profiting from the most heinous of crimes: the trafficking of illicit commodities, sexual servitude, forced labour and people smuggling. It will also help safeguard against potential foreign interference given the proximity of the Torres Strait to the Pacific. We will counter the growing threat of criminals sourcing methamphetamine and cocaine stockpiled in the Pacific. We believe there are tons of illicit commodities that have been stockpiled in the Pacific over many years, giving onshore and offshore organised crime syndicates reliable and easy access to dangerous drugs on the doorstep of Australia. We will do everything in our power to protect you from the scourge of organised crime. We have listened, and we are now acting with deliberate effect. And to the criminals, hear us loud and clear. We are here, and we are coming for you.
The announcement comes as French Polynesia destroyed $2.4 billion of cocaine seized over the past month, while Fijian authorities captured $780 million worth of cocaine in a raid. Dr. John Coyne, Director of National Security at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, told Lucy Cooper, Australia has a strategic and moral obligation to lead efforts in the region.
Unfortunately, Australia's unquenchable thirst for illicit drugs, its willingness to pay higher prices for those drugs and to use them more often than most places in the world, means that there is a highway between cocaine producing and transshipment countries in the Americas through the Pacific to Australia and New Zealand. That's been around for decades, but it's been picking up in pace. We're seeing a whole confluence of organised crime activity in North Queensland. So right from the top. So the one that always puts in people's attention is illicit drugs, but it's not the only one. What we're also seeing is a range of offences, including illegal, unreported and underreported fishing, which has significant impacts on Australia's waters and fisheries, as well as those of the Pacific. We see an agriculture industry that is incredibly reliant and increasingly reliant on bringing Pacific Islanders across as part of the palm scheme into North Queensland. So all of these things are playing together. And what it says is, you know what, North Queensland is not a peripheral to law enforcement, and it's not a peripheral to our relationship with the Pacific.
Why are we seeing the increasing number of illicit drug seizures, and also evidence really of an increasing presence of crime syndicates in the Pacific region?
They are a direct result of years and years of capacity development investment in the region in terms of law enforcement and customs agencies. So they are seizing more drugs. But you know what, the big driver of this, and we cannot walk away from it at all, is that Australians and New Zealanders have a love affair with cocaine. They pay and are willing to pay comparatively large prices for that cocaine. They use it more often, and they use more of it. And what that means than other markets, what that means is that there's that constant pull factor for illicit drug smuggling. So while we've seen increased seizures, they should not be read that we're disrupting the supply chains. They're just part of the next phase of dealing with this significant problem.
In that sense, then, does Australia have an obligation for the region to act?
Look, absolutely. So for the most part, the problem isn't in illicit drugs being sold to Pacific Islanders. The problem for Pacific Island countries, with some exceptions like Fiji, the problem is the corruption and foreign bribery offences, the money laundering that is created as a result of this trade. But we should make no mistakes that Australia has an obligation, because it is our demand for drugs which is driving that, along with New Zealand. So we do have that obligation because we're part of that problem. We have the obligation because our nations are neighbours, and we've made long-term commitments to development across the Pacific.
The AFP Commissioner said that tons of illicit commodities have been stockpiled in the Pacific over many years, which crime syndicates could seek to bring into Australia. Is this well known, and why are drugs being stockpiled, as the AFP Commissioner say they are?
Look, I don't have access to the same information that the AFP Commissioner has access to. Suffice to say that for well over, say, almost 20 years, there's persistent rumours that illicit drugs are smuggled into the Pacific Island region, and that they're stockpiled in certain countries, including Fiji, Papua New Guinea. What we can say is that there has been a steady flow of cocaine into the Australian market. In terms of strategy, a lot more work needs to be done to cut down the supply of cocaine and methamphetamine into Australia.
And that's Dr. John Coyne, Director of National Security at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. Well, a drive-by shooting that injured a former rugby league star and the arrest of two people, including a 15-year-old, has put the media spotlight on a Sydney gang war. At the centre of the conflict is an old Lebanese crime family and a group dubbed the Coconut Cartel, with links to the Pacific community. Well, who are the Coconut Cartel and what impact is the media coverage having on the Pacific community there in Sydney? Joining us this morning to chat about this is Fijian Giorgi Ravulo, Professor of Social Work and Policy Studies at the University of Sydney. With that, I say, Bula Giorgi, and welcome to the show.
Nisa, Bula Vanaka, and g'day. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Look, thank you so much for joining us this morning. I think firstly, for listeners who, you know, may only have seen the headlines, can we just maybe start off with, like, who is the so-called Coconut Cartel and how did this controversy actually start?
Yeah, so from our understanding, the Coconut Cartel is a breakaway group from the Al-Medine family group that was notorious, an underworld sort of gang that's been known for a while here in Sydney. And so they believe that they're now a separate group that are now sort of crime for hire, especially when it comes to creating issues out in the community and retaliating or creating retaliating attacks across the community.
Wow. And with you just saying that, like a group who is, you know, crime for hire, we understand because of that, a prominent name, Matt Utai, his name has been raised in discussion, you know, about the so-called Coconut Cartel. I think for that, though, Giorgi, is there a risk that linking a former NRL player to drug or gang narratives somehow reinforces, you know, that long-standing stereotype about Pacific men and criminality?
Yeah, it does definitely perpetuate that there are stereotypes. They're saying that it's to do with the son at Utah, and he's connected to the crime family. What it does definitely is around how we are perceived as Pacific men across the community. There is a history of our involvement in the criminal justice system, especially from the younger age, coming to system of years old. And I think by particular images or these particular areas of representation of our Pacific young men, it does definitely type about our engagement in crime.
Giorgi, sorry, you were sort of dropping out there. I'm wondering whether maybe you could just move to a different spot or somehow. But while you're doing that, I'm hoping you could answer this question too. How is the Coconut Cartel narrative being linked to, like, broader discussions about Pacific crime in Australia?
It's further highlighted the need for us to be more aware around how and why we're involved in crime in the first place. A lot of the research suggests that it's because of significant social and welfare concerns and the need for us to be more involved in different areas of society, including education and employment. A lot of the issues that they highlight is around the lower socioeconomic status that we generally might find ourselves in, especially if we're living in areas of public housing. And for a lot of young Pacific men, they see these particular opportunities to participate in gangs as a financial opportunity to support themselves and their families. So a lot of the time, the incentive is to actually get involved in representing their area, which a lot of time is connected also to their identity of belonging. And then they are also then remunerated for their involvement. So then that also is an incentive for their involvement and engagement in such activities.
Well, if anything, when we think about this, Giorgi, you know, at the heart of it, what then is really at stake here for our Pacific communities in Australia and what really needs to happen next?
Yeah, what's at stake is our ability to engage well in different parts of society. If we continue to turn up in these particular spaces, then it does perpetuate that ongoing stereotype and trope. At the same time, we do need to put a level of responsibility back on our different social systems to be better when it comes to engaging our young people. If we're not providing them with opportunities to see that their future is bright through things like education and employment, then they are going to continue to get involved in these activities. They're going to see this as a viable opportunity for them to engage. So that includes, you know, participating in gangs and violence and other areas of concern that's not going to necessarily be helpful for themselves and their families.
Mm. Well, what about the language? You know, if being used, does the language being used, risk reinforcing stereotypes about Pacific Islanders, you know, especially for our young Pacific Australians who are watching this unfold right in front of their eyes?
Oh, definitely. The notion of muscle for hire is of concern. And I think that's the thing that we're also seeing play out. Because physically our young men are generally bigger in size, especially when they're younger and they're getting older. And they're also seeing these opportunities as fleeting moments in time. They're not necessarily thinking about the consequences of these particular actions. It does then perpetuate a cycle of crime that they may continue to be involved in as they get older. So developmentally and as they age, they do then get entrenched in these particular patterns of behaviour. So that is of concern and something that we do need to address. At the same time, as a community, we need to continue to rally behind such individuals to support them, to know that they are part of something bigger, that they don't have to be involved in these particular activities to get by, to actually thrive, because a lot of time they're involved in these activities to survive rather than actually see themselves as something bigger.
Yeah. Another thing I'm really interested about is, you know, how should media, including Pacific media, responsibly report on internal community tensions like this?
I think we need to understand the human element associated with this. It's very, very easy for us to see such individuals as being these entities that are inhumane, or that they, you know, need to be locked up and the keys need to be thrown away, that sort of stuff. And then it deters our ability to then create sustainable solutions for people. If we don't see them as people that need support and assistance beyond the situations and circumstances that they're in, then we create an ongoing cycle of disadvantage and marginalization. So we create concern for their ability to be included in their own communities. So that's what's really key here. We need to create opportunities for people to feel like they're involved in their own communities, because that's what also happens, is that a lot of time such young people don't feel like they belong. So they get involved in these criminal activities to have that sense of connection, that sense of belonging. So we do need to flip the script in the way in which we understand such young people and how we can then engage them beyond their current situations and circumstances.
Can I ask though, Georgie, how does that practically look though? And I know we can talk about it, you know, till the cows come home, but I think practically, what does that look like for the community, even for law enforcement? How do we really come together to somehow push this out?
So for police, it's definitely applying community-oriented police practices. So this idea of being able to focus on creating connections with community rather than actually seeing them as a threat. I think a lot of the times in such areas, people feel threatened by the police as opposed to feel a sense of community and connection to police. So that then can create tensions in community. And then as family members, we can create scope for them to have conversations with us about what's happening in their lives. How can we support them in their journey, especially across different areas of education and employment, but even with their health and well-being and how they engage in those particular areas. So it really is about creating a whole of community and even a whole of government approach to working on areas of youth crime that can support our Pacific people.
Georgie, always great to catch up with you. Really appreciate your time this morning.
Likewise, Naka.
Thank you. That, of course, is Professor of Social Work and Policy Studies at the University of Sydney, Georgie Ravulo. If you just joined us, thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie DuBois. It's been a bit of a full-on morning already with stories of the Fiji Independent Commission Against Corruption, who was again under intense scrutiny after it arrested a prominent online writer who'd published allegations made by an internal whistleblower. Also, Palau's Supreme Court has denied an application by the country's Senate for a stay order on the government's plan to take third country nationals deported from the United States. And you would have just heard we spoke about the coconut cartel and its links to the Pacific community here in Australia after recent shootings involving a former rugby league player.
What's up, ABC Radio Australia listeners? I'm Sosafina Formoli, and I want you to come hang with me for On The Record, your weekly deep dive into the music that moves the Pacific. We'll talk about the big tracks that inspire your favourite Pacific music artists and the real stories behind them. Plus, we'll uncover some gems that you might not know yet, keeping the heart of the Pacific alive and thumping. Catch On The Record Mondays at 3 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
All right, to the world of sport now. It was a feast of Pacific football as round three of the OFC Pro League landed in Melbourne over the weekend. Table toppers Auckland FC were held to a 1-1 draw by South Melbourne, while South Island United and Tahiti United drew 2-2 on the opening day. Sunday delivered the drama with Vanuatu United claiming their first Pro League win, beating Fiji's Bulla FC 2-0 in a thrilling contest. And just before the Melbourne skies opened up, the Solomon Kings and Papua New Guinea's Hikari went head-to-head on a slick, rain-soaked pitch. Evan Wasuka with the report.
The Melbourne drizzle could not keep the die-hard soccer fans away. Even when it turned into a downpour, the flags were out and the chanting got louder.
I travel from Tongala. It's like 3 hours. It's a farmland away from Melbourne. I came here 3 hours just to be here to cheer me for my country. My country, Papua New Guinea.
Thank you, Thomas.
Go Hekari PNG.
That's Koriak Upaiga, a former Papua New Guinea national rep. He's a former Hekari player as well. And on Sunday night, he was the club's number one fan. He defied the rain, running up and down the sideline, waving a PNG flag. But he couldn't drown out the chants. The Solomon Kings started strong, dominating the first half, leading 1-0 into the break with a goal to Japanese import Higashide Sota. A second-half goal to Junior David gave the Kings just enough to stay ahead, despite Hekari Shane Sakiel scoring in the 77th minute. Watching from the stand, Solomon Island's master student, Peter Sam Ramofolo, says it was a special moment watching his team here in Melbourne.
But having the our Solomon Island community here in Melbourne to come and actually support our boys, it's really, really good for our boys. And I know it's another... The 12th player in the field for them, I guess.
Their presence, says Solomon Kings captain Philip Mango, was certainly felt on the field.
I would like to thank the supporters to come out in number today to support us, the boys. By looking at the supporters turn out today, it's really motivate us players to do our best because they spend 5 hours just to travel and watch us playing here today. So we would like to give back the victory for them.
Hekari's coach, Solomon Islander Jerry Allen, says it's back to the drawing board for his team, with more games coming up in the week ahead. But he did send out a vote of thanks to their number one fan, the man running with the flag, Koriak Upaiga.
He came out today with the other players to come, other supporters to come. So I think, thank you, Lem. Next time, Karim, come plenty more.
As for Koriak Upaiga, well, he wished he could wind back the clock and join the boys back on the field in this new Pro League.
I have wished this have happened in my time. This is a privilege for these young boys. And thank you to the initiative for the OFC that to bring the Pro League into the Pacific to build our players.
We need this kind of initiative to, you know, like build our players from the Pacific. Just let them go and explore what is outside the world. Because we can't keep ourselves here. So we may keep him here outside here. Our football in Pacific, it will be like that. And to come out and like play in this Pro League, man, it's a big thing.
And that's Koriaku Paiga, former PNG national soccer player and former Hikari player and super fan. That story from Evan Wasuka. And the OFC Pro League's third round continues this week here in Melbourne. Now, there's a new man at the helm of Cricket PNG, and he's made the commitment, which overseas coaches employed in Papua New Guinea are often reluctant to make, and that's to live and work in the country full-time. Tim McCaskill has taken over as head of high performance and as coach of the Barramundis after years of experience with Cricket Victoria in Australia and in Sri Lanka. His first big task is coming up in May, when the Barras will set out on the road to what they hope will be qualification for the T20 World Cup in Australia and New Zealand in 2028. And after a prolonged period of turmoil over pay and conditions prior to his arrival, Tim McCaskill is confident he can get cricket and PNG back on track.
Essentially for me, all I've been concentrating on is what we have, where we're going, not too worried about what has taken place in the past. All I can do is concentrate on what we've got in front of us as a group. We've got the Barocco Motors Big Bash coming up during March, which is the T20 performance competition for the greater cricket community. So there's players from outside the squads that are flown in from other regions, and there's a wider talent pool within Port Moresby and other communities that get the opportunity to play in that tournament. So that'll be my first real opportunity to see what the talent footprint looks like. Then following that tournament, we are full on into our preparation for the May series in Japan.
In terms of working out the makeup of the squad for the T20 qualifier, you're starting with the blank page essentially, and the team might look very different from the team that last took to the field for PNG.
Potentially, it's like everyone. Many eyes see different things. The way I look at a cricketer might be different to the way others have seen a cricketer. I might see potential and be looking to invest time, effort and energy into that. So we'll be taking our best available team to that tournament, regardless of whether it's a mixture of last times or new ones, and it'll be what we're deeming the best available at that time.
What about the situation of the captaincy? Is Asad Vala still number one in that role?
From where I'm sitting, yes. There's also discussions that have to take place to see where he is and what he's wanting to do, and at some stage there does need to be a transition and an opportunity to start a fresh qualification cycle might be it, as is currently playing cricket in Melbourne. And you know, I haven't had the opportunity to sit down one-on-one with him to talk through that, but from what I've seen, Sese Bauer, he's emerging as someone that's driving high standards. So those captaincy discussions will be something that takes place in the March period, and then there'll be board meetings and decisions will be made at that time.
And when you look at some of the results that have emerged from the current T20 World Cup, Nepal nearly knocked off the English, the Italians had a win, and PNG can not just be a match for those teams, but beat those teams at their best. So there's really something to aim for here in terms of getting them back to where they were maybe 2 or 3 years ago.
Absolutely. And the beauty of that tournament being on at the moment is you've got the opportunity to point everyone towards that and say that could have been you, and what do we need to do to get there? So, you know, I'm certainly using that tournament and teams that are in that tournament now as motivation for everyone that's here to say, you know, we've got to push hard and we've got to get fitter, faster, stronger. And that when the opportunity presents itself, beat them again like we have in previous years.
And you travelled to Nepal with the national women's team. And yep. Arguably, I mean, they're ahead of the men currently, aren't they, on the world rankings? And they've been doing better over the last year or two.
On the rankings, yep, they have been. And they went through their series of qualifiers and put themselves in a position to go to the World Cup. Unfortunately, we stumbled on the last hurdle to get into the first sort of checkpoint in that tournament of making the Super Six phase. We got beat by the USA in the last round. And that was probably one that got away. And that would have been you're in the Super Six, and then when you're in the Super Six, you're potentially one of four teams. And again, when you look at that tournament, the Netherlands have gone through. They beat the Netherlands when they played their series in Thailand at the back end of last year. We've been competitive and beaten Scotland at other stages as well. So they're certainly touching the line. Got to just lift a few areas of the game here and there to just make sure we cut that tape ahead of others.
Past experience includes working with Cricket Victoria, working with cricket in Sri Lanka, but this is very different to what you've experienced before, or is it?
It's vastly different where, you know, you're working in the Victorian system and pushing players into the Australian system in a very different cricket environment with more players, more depth, more access to facilities and equipment. Then you go to Sri Lanka and it was completely different experience in that you go into a country that lived and breathed the game, and so you didn't have to try very hard to get everyone motivated. But the experiences in Sri Lanka are probably more that I'm drawing on when I'm in this environment here, in terms of just that natural ability of players and the sort of untapped talent pool that's available. But the thing that's vastly different is what you get access to in those main, you know, tier one test playing nations. You've got access to more, where as an associate you're high performing with what you have available. And you know, I'm based here in Port Moresby, my wife's here with me, we're sort of saying that there's no opportunity to make inroads in the game if you're not all in. So I'm definitely all in, but it's still really fresh. You just got to try and look at what you've got and say what we're going to make from this, and no excuses, and push ahead.
And that's Tim McCaskill, the new head of high performance at Cricket PNG and head coach of the Barramundis, and on the line from the place he calls home now, and that's Port Moresby. Tim was talking to Richard Hewitt. Time to take a look back at one of our main stories today. Fiji's Independent Commission Against Corruption has arrested a prominent online writer who'd published allegations made by an internal whistleblower.
Charlie Chatters was stopped at Nandi Airport while he was on his way to board a Fiji Airways flight to Sydney. As of last night, the FICAC investigators were still not done with their caution interview with him.
Find those stories when you type Pacific Beach or Radio Australia into your search engine. But our team will be back at the same time at 6 a.m. PNG time tomorrow. But you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time with Richard Hewitt. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia because your news is next. Coming up after that, it's Nisha Daily. So until next time, o tua o whātou. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.